Governor Freudenthal, thank you very much for the invitation to be here. Also, thank you for your friendship. It is a great pleasure for me to work with Dave Freudenthal, and it is a great pleasure to be back with Western Governors Association, all of my friends and colleagues, and once again to see the strength of the organization by the addition of the premiers. That's something that goes back a number of years, and again, I appreciate seeing the premiers here as well. I was asked if I wrote a note here. I did not. I've written with Governor Huntsman. I've written with Governor Rounds. Governor Schweitzer, when there was a WGA meeting in Missoula, I wrote a harley to that. And over Highway 12 in Lolo Pass is one of the most exquisite routes there is. When I left that meeting 2 days later, I left as a solo biker. And there were two police officers of Missoula City Police that had their Harley motorcycles, and they said, "Do you mind if you ride with me?" I said, "No, I would love that." And so, divided highway, we went out of town. Rather than pull into the right lane, they stayed in the left. And I guess you don't have speed limits. So these motors were coming up on my tailpipes. I was the first biker they encountered. They saw there were two more up ahead of the riding. They thought we should pull the right lane, and I was staying with my escort here. So they would pass. It was interesting, the different signals they would give as they passed. And they just thought there were two more bikers ahead. They didn't realize there were these badges painted on their fuselage. And so then immediately you'd always see the tail lamps come on and they drop back in formation, and I would signal them too. John Rocha, what a pleasure to be on the same day as the station. If it's Sunday, it's Meet the Press. Those words have very special meaning. When we saw that you were asked to step in and to be the moderator of Meet the Press for the foreseeable future, it made perfect sense for NBC to go to the senior leader of that outstanding team. We applaud. As I've traveled in this setting for people, we don't even know each other, but it's amazing how many folks volunteer what Tim Russert meant to them, where they've never met. And America lost a friend. And I had the great occasion to be with him at different times and just to talk with him. He was every bit as down to earth in person as you saw on TV. And sometimes we don't get to say something to someone in the professions. So I thought perhaps on behalf of all the governors and the people of America, say to Tom Brokaw, I'd like to thank you for the professionalism which you bring to journalism, civility, and the fairness which you bring. It is greatly appreciated. I was with Governor Schwarzenegger this week, and apparently you did a pre-recorded something with him for this morning. I didn't get to see some of the TV sets where we're staying, but he was telling me, he said that Tom Brokaw and Governor Schwarzenegger are friends for many years, and the first question that Tom asked him was, well, Governor, 6% unemployment, your economy's in the tank, $50 billion deficit. If this were Wall Street, they'd say the CEO has to go. And I said, Arnold, how did you respond? He said, I'm glad you're in a good humor. I always have recognized, I think the fact that you have so many people here today that travel many distances, one of the strengths of the Western Governors Association is its bipartisan approach. I never experienced partisanship when I was here. I have not experienced partisanship from you governors of the Western Governors Association in my current position. As I said to Janet, I appreciate when she gave me a call and a heads up of an issue that needed some attention. with every one of you. The opportunities I've had to sit down and we solve problems. It's the pragmatism. We don't often see as much bipartisanship in Washington, D.C., at least during this current season. I've mentioned a few of you my thoughts on bipartisanship. When I first arrived in the United States Senate, I had the honor of serving on the Armed Services Committee. And when I was a freshman, I was under the impression that you were supposed to attend your hearings. And there's one particular hearing of the Armed Services Committee. It was a large horseshoe table like this. One party is on one side, the other party is seated on the other, and you're seated by seniority. I was seated in the very last chair, and nobody even noticed I was there because I was the only Republican who was there. Interestingly enough, most of the Democrats were there, and an American icon was speaking, John Glenn. And to sit there and to listen to John Glenn, who I believe is one of our heroes, and what I didn't realize is that the issue he was discussing and presenting, he presented 3 years in a row, never to be successful, because he never had the support of his colleagues. I listened to it and I thought, boy, he makes a great deal of sense. And at that point, there was a staffer behind me leaning forward and he said, "Sir, do you realize you have all the proxy votes of the Republican senators?" And I said, "You're kidding." And he said, "No." So John Glenn wrapped up his arguments and he made a motion for adoption. And there was silence. No one was going to adopt or move for second. So I seconded the motion. At that point, they glanced up. No big deal. It's that new fellow over there. So they called the roll, starting with Sam Nunn, who was the great chairman. Senator Nunn? No. Senator Levin? No. Senator Byrd? No. Senator Kennedy? No. Senator Lieberman? No. Senator Glenn? Aye. This continued the Democrat call, and there were no votes for John except his own. Then they knew it wouldn't take long on the Republican side because nobody was there. Senator Thurmond? Aye by proxy. Senator Warner? Aye by proxy. Senator McCain? Aye by proxy. Every time they called a name, I voted. So I called Kempner and said aye, and they tallied the votes. John Glenn won. Sam Nunn immediately adjourned the hearing. Everybody went out the different doorways, and I went out one set of doors and turned to head back to my office and the rest of them. Standing at the end of the hallway was John Glenn. And as I approached, he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "Well, apparently I'm your new best friend." And we became very close friends. I do believe that there's something very special about being a Western governor. Those of us who've been so honored by the citizens of our states know what it is to have this sacred honor. That's true of the premiers as well. The trust of being stewards of vast and beautiful lands, the trust of serving people whose connection to the land dates back generations and in some cases centuries, people in whom the irrepressible can-do spirit of the frontier is still very much alive. That frontier spirit. I will tell you that when I arrived last night, about 8:30, stepping off that plane, seeing those magnificent Tetons, I did not expect this, Governor Freudenthal, but the stirring that you feel within, knowing that we share those Tetons on the other side is Idaho, our wonderful state, but to be back in the West, the openness, cleanliness, the vitality is tremendous. And the pragmatism which we learn as governors. When I first became Secretary of the Interior, I found that there were a number of issues. During my confirmation process, of the 22 senators that served on that committee, every one of them had some issue with Interior. I would go down them as a to-do list. One of them, for example, was a state on the east. And so I asked the regional people to come in and brief me. What is this issue about? They began the briefing by saying, "We've been working on this for 15 years. And I said, "Well, I need to stop you for just a minute. I don't have 15 years. I said, "We may not reach perfection, but we're going to reach decision." And I said, "Now proceed with the briefing." They laid it out and I said, "Here's how I see it. Can you live with it?" And they said, "Well, if that's the direction." And I said, "Let's get the governor, and the U.S. Senator who had raised these issues with us on the phone. They were of different political parties, and the reaction was, hallelujah, we needed a decision. Well, that's what governors do, and I commend you for what you do. We have tremendous challenges in the West. The 2008 fire season, which Governor Friedman called reference, it is here. Fire seasons now come at least a month earlier, and they last at least a month longer. When I was in California with Governor Schwarzenegger, we went to the northern part in the greater Redding area, where you have treacherous terrain, and they're being hit and have been hit by dry lightning strikes. It can be thousands of lightning strikes per day. What is unusual is that this is happening in May and June. Not unusual in August, but it is starting so much sooner and hitting with such volume of fire. The official fire season doesn't even start until July or August. When we think about the preparation, what can we do for firefighters? One of the realities that we deal with is that 60% of all new homes today are constructed in the wildlife-urban interface. And so the idea of being fire wise and the fire safe council is absolutely important and critical. We saw that in the greater Redding area. They've done a tremendous job. Anything that you can do to get the pool load away from the eaves, because firefighters, number one, are going to protect human life, and then they're going to protect property. We need to make sure that we do all that we can as part of that team. I will note that in 2000, when I was chairman of the Western Government Association and was honored to host this meeting in Coeur d'Alene, we signed the 2000 National Fire Plan. That fire plan gave way to what is now our fuels reduction program. At the Department of the Interior, in the last 8 years, we've now invested $2 billion, and we have treated now 10 million acres. We just treated the 10 millionth acre. That is more acreage than the entire state of Maryland, to give you an idea. And the U.S. Forest Service is doing the same thing on their side of the equation. It shows you that we can get things done. We may not be able to address drought as far as changing it, but we can address reduction in the fuel loads. Also, I want to point out that Premier Dewar and I were the co-authors of the protocol between Canada and the United States with regard to fire suppression, so that whatever team, be they Canadian or American, was closest, regardless of what side of the border they were on, we had a common protocol communication and chemicals so that we could attack it. That protocol still stands. I would also note, thank the Canadians, that because with the National Interagency Fire Center, they are the partners with the Canadian Interagency Fire Center. And while we already have a tough season, we've not yet had to utilize the extension of offer from the Canadians of 10 elite fire crews. But we appreciate you are on standby status. NIFCI, I will tell you what we do with regard to the National Interagency Fire Center. As we coordinate this with all of the federal entities, and I'm very proud of two of those members of my team that are here, Lyle Avery, who is our Assistant Secretary, and Steve Allred, Assistant Secretary, Department of Interior. But continually, 24/7, we evaluate what are the patterns of the weather, what are the fuel loads, and we continually pre-deploy. When the Santa Ana winds hit last fall, we were pre-deployed with personnel and rolling stock. And as bad as it was, it could have been far worse if we don't use that. We still employ the strategy of initial attack, and we're 97% successful with that initial attack. When we talk about the forest season, it gets into something that Dave has referenced, and that is critical habitat. Critical habitat for species such as sage grouse, and what that can mean. Once the fire season is over, we may immediately begin our efforts on restoration, getting the seeds back in the ground so that when the snows come,
when the spring rains come, we can at least have the beginnings to stop the erosion and stop invasive species. But the critical habitat, I want to commend the governors of Idaho, Utah, Nevada, Wyoming, for joint effort, the funds that you put together to help us in partnership on this critical habitat. The BLM, for example, has sent to the National Interagency Fire Center the critical habitat of the sage grouse, so that as we see fires beginning to set up or potential ignition, that is a critical area that we're going to make sure we have resources deployed to hit it, to stop the fire so we don't lose critical habitat. One of the things that we need from the states, and you've responded in extremely good fashion, is information on your state conservation plans so that we incorporate that. The populations of the sage grouse that you see in your respective states and the trends that you're seeing there. We just received Governor Friedenthal from Wyoming 1,000 pages of hard data on the sage grouse. That's the information which we need. BLM is evaluating the critical habitat for the sage grouse because 50% of that habitat is within the jurisdiction of the BLM. And so we're looking at our practices on the land and looking at what you're doing on your area of responsibility and what we could do to closer augment what you're doing in this approach. We remain on target for completing the petition process with regard to the sage grouse this December. And again, it's very important for all of us and the ramifications of that. You think of the critical habitat, and it is very interesting that you often have world-class habitat that is sitting right above world-class energy reserves. They need not be mutually exclusive. It is to our benefit that they are not mutually exclusive. And when you look at the $4 a gallon gas tax, you see what the implications of that are for American family with regard to fuel and food. We need to do all that we can to responsibly and environmentally develop our energy resources. The Healthy Lands Initiative, which President Bush placed in the budget for 2008, which we continue in 2009, takes this approach so that we're not so focused on acre by acre that we lose sight of the bigger picture of the total ecosystem. Now we're looking at a much greater vision of ridgetop to ridgetop, a more holistic approach, which is going to be very, very important. Some of the trends, therefore, that are happening in the energy situation. Traditionally, what has been 10 to 5 acres per wellhead is being dramatically changed. We're now getting to the point that one wellhead can occupy one-third of an acre instead of that 10 acres. With the multi-directional drilling, this is something that, as the industry can tell you, much of this has been perfected in the offshore, the Outer Continental Shelf, going in multi-directions. Now employing that same strategy here on land allows us to get down to this much less footprint on the acreage. The liquid gathering system, which we've had, because there is a byproduct of condensation that comes from this process, maybe water and kerosene. And so as this condensation is acquired, it's placed in tanks, and then you have a continual daily transportation of the tanker trucks to take it to different locations. But now we're going to a liquid gathering system that will be by pipeline. We've already been able to replace tens of thousands of truck traffic trips per day. And our goal is ultimately 160,000 truck trips will be eliminated. You realize what that means to the infrastructure of not needing the additional roads? You realize what that means to the clean air? Because with the trucks and the diesel engines, you have the NOx. With the tanks, you have the volatile organic compounds, and so you have adverse effect of the ozone. This is going to be very positive with regard to that. The pipeline being underground and also under the road, so that we continue to remove the disturbance that is being caused, and also now putting utilities underground in the same area under that road. The BLM has now set a goal that with regard to the activities at the wellheads, where we've traditionally had the diesel engines and the compressors, We now are going to natural gas as the means of generating those. A goal of no emissions in 4 years with regard to the NOx. A variety of things are taking place. Again, we look at the north in Alaska, where we've realized the benefit of the ice roads. So that when you go out to an area and you do the development of a wellhead, but then as the spring thaw comes, we withdraw the activity, leaving no footprint. We're doing the same thing in this region of the country, using the wooden mats, setting them out, going out to the area where the development takes place, putting satellite remote machinery so that we can then monitor all of this, remove the mats, and find that we have not had damage to the sagebrush, which is critical habitat for the sage grouse. One of the positive unintended consequences is that it serves as a moisture gatherer. And so you actually see that the sagebrush absolutely comes back. All these technologies are being developed and now being put into place. In fact, in Colorado, Woodland Ritter, I believe the energy industry is the number one purchaser of solar panels so that they can use these for their remote locations. It shows you what is taking place. But I also want to complete the view of energy, that it's not just strictly on oil and gas, but it's on the alternatives and it's on the renewables. The BLM issued 380 geothermal leases. Compare that to 25 in the last 4 years. BLM has 180 wind energy leases since 2001. Currently, we have 15 additional developments in the states of Arizona, California, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, Utah, Wyoming, the western states. BLM has more than 150 applications for utility-scale solar energy projects in the states of California, Nevada, Arizona, Colorado, New Mexico. And also our Minerals Management Service, which is part of the Department of the Interior, will have a proposed rule on alternative energy production in the Outer Continental Shelf next month. This is going to give us a layout of the regulatory process for wind, wave, and current energy development. Now, one final issue that I'd like to mention to you is a precious commodity. You know, it's interesting when we think of precious commodities. Gold currently is selling for about $900 an ounce. Deny a human water for 72 hours and offer them an ounce of gold or an ounce of water and see which one is truly precious. We're all realizing that water is finite. We're realizing all throughout the United States and throughout the world. When I led the U.S. delegation to the Global Earth Observation Summit last December to Cape Town, South Africa, 73 nations, but talking about climate change, talking about drought, all of the implications that that has, and what we can do about it, how we can share this data. After the last fall, when I was literally the morning that I was briefing the president in the Roosevelt Room on the Santa Ana winds and how we were dealing with that wind and getting it contained, walking across the hall to the cabinet meeting, and after that cabinet meeting, I was informed that I was going to Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. And I said, why would I go there? And they said, because the next fire is drought. And because you're a Western governor, and you've dealt with drought. And so I went down there and I met with Sonny Perdue, Bob Riley, Charlie Kish, working on this whole thing of drought in the Southeast. When you look again at the 7-state Colorado River Compact, what has been achieved? That is the most significant accomplishment since 1922 when the compact was first put on the books. It is very easy for all of us to deal in times of surplus, but to deal in times of scarcity is truly tough. And this record of decision which I signed, which reflects the work of your 7 states, is tremendous. It is a role model throughout the United States, and I believe even the world. What do you do to share scarcity? There's a variety of programs that we're working. The president has included in this upcoming budget initiative, Water for America. We haven't had a water census in 30 years. And I'm not sure how accurate it is. because of stream gauges that are not in major tributaries, in major watersheds, and to update stream gauges that we need. What is the interaction between the groundwater, the surface water, the spring water? All of this needs to be part of the data that we have so that we can make better decisions. When I was chairman of the Western Governors Association in 2000, the theme that I built on was the power of partnering. I believe it more so even today. Governor Schweitzer of Montana, I visited what was called the Blackfoot Challenge. You're very familiar with that. It's the Blackfoot River, made famous by the book A River Runs Through. You go there and you find that the ranch families, we went to Jim Stone's ranch, Rolling Stones, and his children, and the ranch families standing there with their federal friends, their state friends, and putting up easels out of this beautiful meadow, saying they were concerned what was happening, that they weren't going to have the traditional lifestyle, that they no longer had the fisheries, they no longer had the wildlife habitat. They, years ago, determined that it was more efficient, that if you wanted to get water from point A to B, you just put in a pipe. But now, by going back and breaking up what in essence was a pipe and letting the natural meandering take place, how ironic that on the east side, how the aquatic life has come back, how the waterfowl have returned. Now they have fish, and fish is an indicator of how well they're doing. They are so proud of this. There is this synergy of the partnership between the public and private sector. And as I listened to this, I said, ladies and gentlemen, this may surprise you, but if I put those very maps on your easels and took the very message which you just delivered, but insert a few other names that all coincide with the Everglades, we're doing the same thing in the Everglades. We're doing the same thing throughout the United States, a variety of things. So we have enormous challenges as a country. We have enormous opportunities as well. And we have so many successes, so many best practices that we're now being able to build upon. So it's just a great pleasure for me to once again be back to an organization that I have the greatest of affection and respect for, the Western Governors Association, and to be back with my friends, the governors, who do a great job for all of the states of the United States. God bless you.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I'm always amazed how such a troublesome agency can be headed by such a charming man.